Live and local, we are Acadiana's sports station. 103.7 The Game. KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Raging Cajun legend Brian Mitchell.
My dream was always to play in the NFL, so having that opportunity was the main thing I needed.
LSU College World Series hero Warren Morris.
I don't get tired of talking about it. You know, if people remember me for that home run and winning that championship, I think that's great.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Corey Acton now looking for his first hit. That is high in the air. Deep to right. Is it deep enough? It is. Acton with his first home run of the year. It's a three-run blast. And the Gators have completely opened up a can here in Baton Rouge.
Good morning and good Friday, Acadiana. This is RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. I am your host, Raymond Parch III. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. You can give us a call today on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, as always, 337-706-0111. Once again, ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. We've got a terrific show lined up for you today. We'll talk Saints with our boy Barry. That's right, Barry Hurstis. He's going to be coming up at 7:32. You have to tune in for that. We'll have Tyler Nunez, as always, from Tiger Rag. He's going to dive in a little bit deeper about Joe Oliva no longer being the athletic director, the new athletic director with the ties to BR and to LSU, and where does LSU Athletics go from here. That'll be coming up in the third and final hour at 8:32. Special treat lined up for you. Coming up at the start of the third hour, Mike Dettillier. That's right, NFL draft expert. You probably have his draft report in your hand as we speak. He's going to be joining us live right here on RP3 and Company. And then also, Kyle Cormier, the head baseball coach, longtime baseball coach at Brobridge High School. His team is ranked as the number one team in all of Class 4A. They wrap up the regular season tonight. We have an interview with him lined up at 7:02. Plus my rant of the week, RPOs with RP3, and even a Louisiana wrap-up. So we got a lot to get to. But we're going to start things off with the LSU baseball team. So that happened. A team that had been struggling with a loss at Southern, dropping 2 of 3 at Mizzou, losing to UL at the Wally Pontiff Classic, dealing with a slew of injuries, dealing with morale being down. Expectations were LSU was going to bounce back in a big way there at Alex Box Stadium. They were back at home. Not the chilly conditions of Columbia, Missouri. Not in the non-friendly confines of Southern University. Or even the Wally Pontiff Classic, where they played that at the Shrine on Airline. They were back home, inside Alex Box Stadium, against a Florida team that has a losing record in SEC play. Yes, they're the number 25 ranked team in the country. But they were 3 games under .500 in the SEC. Yes, Zach Hess, who has been up and down, inconsistent as all get out all year, was not going to be able to take the bump for him. Groin injury. So they turn the ball over to Mikhail Hilliard, who's been pitching well. He came off of injury from last season, slow to recover. They've been bringing him along slowly but surely, a lot of midweek appearances. He steps up, and he gets shelled. Florida comes out and whoops up on LSU. 16-9. That's a football score. That's two touchdowns, two extra points, and a safety. While LSU got three field goals. Okay?
Sounds about right.
I think my math is correct there.
Yes. Oh, no, I mean just the LSU getting three field goals after giving up two touchdowns and a safety. Sounds about right.
Bravo. Good job, Mr. Schutz. Good Friday to you, brother.
Good Friday, sir.
16-9. What is going on with this LSU baseball team? Ron Higgins, who we had on the program yesterday, friend of the show, one of the best, maybe in my opinion, the best LSU beat writer I've ever been around. He says the sky's not falling. LSU fans shouldn't panic. And I would agree with that because there's still some time to kind of ride the ship, and they have this slew of injuries. But, bro, you cannot get wally-mopped at your own place 16-9. Come on. Florida improves to 26-14 overall, 7-9 in the SEC, while LSU now falls to 24-15 and 9-7 in league play. Game two of the series is going to be tonight, 7 p.m., first pitch, 6:30 pregame. You can listen to both of those things live right here on 103.7 The Game. Bumper to Bumper Sports is going to be doing a live remote with the good brother Ben Love at Ruffino's on the River. He's going to lead you up to LSU pregame later this afternoon. Florida starter Tommy Mace, he improved to 7-3 on the year. After throwing seven innings, the powerful righty, he only allowed four runs on 10 hits, but he walked nine. He only struck out two. So, once again, yes, the winning pitcher walked nine batters. And LSU could not get those guys to cross home plate. They had runner after runner after runner on the base paths, whether it was with walks or with hits. Once again, if you tell me that the starting pitcher in this ball game gave up 10 hits and walked nine batters, you'd be like, that's the guy that lost. That's the guy who was on the team that gave up 16 runs. Wrong. That's the winning pitcher. Florida threw out a guy who had a terrible outing. Not a good performance by any stretch of the imagination. You don't give up four runs, you don't give up 10 hits, and you sure as hell don't walk nine batters and win a ball game. Somehow, Florida found a way to do that. Mikhail Hilliard, who had been making strides, he fell to 0-2 on the year after suffering the loss. He allowed six runs on just seven hits, walked one, struck out three. He only lasted two innings. This is what Paul Maneri had to say afterwards. In my time here at LSU, I don't remember having more than a handful of these kind of games. Our pitching wasn't at the efficient level it needed to be, and we dug ourselves a big hole early in the game. Unfortunately, the game got out of hand, but we fought back to get 16 hits and score nine runs. We just got off to a bad start. Florida was putting the bat on the ball, and they just got to us. The best thing we can do is flush and forget about it and get ready for game two. I agree with what Paul says there. They did get 16 hits. They did score nine runs. You gave up 16.
You didn't start scoring until you were down 10-0.
Right, right.
Like, I don't care how many runs. If you don't start scoring until you're down 10-0, that is a tough call.
It's comparable in a football game when the other team races out to a 45-10 lead, and in the fourth quarter, because they got their backups in and they got prevent defense out on the field, you put together the three touchdown drives. It doesn't look that bad in the final box score if you're not watching the game or listening to the game live on 103.7 The Game. LSU had its chances. They did. Josh Smith led off the bottom of the fifth inning with a single up the middle. And with one out, center fielder Antoine Duplantis, who had himself a game, and third baseman Drew Bianco, stroked base hits to load the bases. And then with two outs, first baseman Cade Beloso slapped a single up the middle to bring in Smith and Duplantis. That's when they finally got it together. At that point, Cody, it was 13-2. 13-2. Florida tacked on a couple more runs. Florida's Smith had a solo home run with two outs in the top of the eighth to make it a 15-4 game. Saul Garza, who's been dealing with an injury for LSU, he hit his first career home run, a solo shot to right center in the bottom of the eighth. So that was something. Despite getting trucked 16-9, despite that, they still have two games to play. They can still win this weekend series. They can still keep pace in the SEC West standings. All that's still on the table. Antoine Duplantis had himself a heck of a game, as I mentioned. He went 4-for-5, scored a run, had one RBI. Had himself a pretty good game. And look, LSU got guys on. Josh Smith was 2-for-6, scored two runs. Daniel Cabrera, two hits. Kay Beloso, two hits. Brant Broussard, two hits. Giovanni, I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
DiGiacomo.
Thank you. He had two hits. Saul Garza even had a hit. They had guys get on base. Didn't score. And then the pitching just was awful. I mean, after they ran Hilliard out of the game, who gave up, once again, six runs on seven hits and just two innings of work, Chase Costello wasn't much better because he gave up four runs on six hits and two innings of work. Some other guys got some, you know, got some experience. Clay Moffitt came in. It wasn't good for him either because he gave up three earned runs on two hits and didn't even last a third of an inning. Now, I want to say Jaden Hill is going to be pitching tonight. Is that correct?
I think it's Cole Henry tonight.
Is it Cole Henry?
I think so. Let me check. I'm pretty sure it's Cole Henry.
Producer extraordinaire is going to find out.
I believe it's Cole Henry tonight, Eric Walker tomorrow.
So, LSU fans, you feel confident? You're down one game. You get absolutely trucked by them Gators. I think you're right. It is.
Yeah, Cole Henry. Cole Henry tonight.
Jane's still banged up. I get him confused.
Game three.
And then Walker will be game three.
Yeah, Cole Henry, I mean, 3.45 ERA. Not bad.
So, LSU fan, do you feel confident that your team can turn around and win these next two games tonight and Saturday?
I mean, Tommy Mace, best record for Florida. He was 6-3, but slightly above 4 ERA, 4.1. Tonight, Jack Leftwich for Florida's throwing, right-hander, 4-2, so not a bad record, but 4.5 ERA. And then in game three, the guy starting for Florida, right-handed once again, 4.6 ERA. So there's some inflated ERAs coming to the mound here for Florida the next two games.
Their pitching staff isn't great.
Well, the whole team hasn't played. I'm not going to say the team is not great because the team has probably got a lot of talent.
They're trending. Yeah, they overcame a rough start, and they've grown up, and they're starting to trend in the right direction.
No matter how you slice it, 7-9 in conference is not a great run so far.
Not a good look. I think I feel more confident about who's taking the bump tonight if I'm an LSU fan. You have to feel good about the lineup finally getting its bats going, even though the game was well out of hand. But still, could that confidence carry over into today's game? You hope so. I worry about the Saturday game, though, Cody, because Eric Walker has been struggling, and he shows that he's great or good. He still has not returned to the form, the pre-injury form that he displayed when he helped them get to the College World Series. You hope that you're going to get something good in that third game, which is likely going to be a rubber match. You hope it's going to be a rubber match. If not, not a great night on the diamond for the LSU Tigers. But they weren't the only team that struggled Raging Cajuns appeared that they were going to take game one of their weekend series, and then everything came off the rails there at UT Arlington. We'll dive into that next here on RP3 and Company on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parsa III, here on 103.7 The Game. Cody Schutz is on the ones and twos as always, and we're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. You can give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline if you'd like, 337-706-0111. LSU got themselves punched in the mouth by the Florida Gators last night at Alex Box Stadium. UL, meanwhile, who defeated LSU in the Wally Pontiff Jr. Classic back on Tuesday, with that victory, had gotten to 20-20 overall, 500 for the season. They were already had a winning record in conference play at 8-7. And they were looking to build some of that momentum from taking two or three from South Al, beating LSU in the midweek contest, as they traveled for a three-game set for this Easter weekend at UT Arlington. Sun Belt Series, try to end the season strong, and try to get some consistency going for Tony Robichaux's bunch. But they fell 9-8. They dropped the opener. Gunnar Leje was tagged with the loss. He's now 1-3 on the season. And here's the frustrating thing if you're the Raging Cajuns. You jump right out. You score two runs. You add another one in the third. The second. You're tied because UT Arlington comes back with three in the bottom of the second. But then you score two more runs in the fifth. And after you score three runs in the top of the eighth, you're up. You're up 8-4. Once again, UL plates three in the top of the eighth. They have eight runs. They head to the bottom of the eighth, six outs away from claiming a win in the opening game of the three-game set at UT Arlington, and they give up five runs in the next two innings to drop it 9-8. Five unanswered runs in the final two innings. Five. They looked primed to take that game one. The way they performed, especially at the plate, you were like, yes, here they come. Here comes the Raging Cajuns. But they left the first game there at Clay Gould Ballpark in disappointing fashion. For the third time this season, the Cajuns fell in a game in which they were leading after eight frames. Junior Todd Lott, though, did have himself a huge night. He went 4-for-5 at the plate with four RBIs. One of those hits was a two-run dinger, his fifth home run of the season, and the team's 43rd on the year. Lott became the first member of the team to record four hits in a game since Hayden Cantrell, the former Terlings Catholic star, did so back on March 19th against Northwestern State. Cantrell also had a big night. He went 3-for-5 with two runs score. Former STM star Brennan Brough went 2-for-3, two runs score. And Jordan Wiley went 2-for-2 with a run scored. And Daniel LaHare also added two hits. So your lineup did its job. Multiple hit games for multiple players. But Gunner was not great. He gave up all five of those runs. Your guy that was an All-American candidate that's supposed to be a starter that you have in the bullpen, you put him out there because you're thinking this is the guy, he's the vet, he's going to shut things down, he's going to take care of business, he's going to get these final six outs for us to get out of here with a win. He gave up five runs, four of which were earned, in only two innings. Now, UTA is the, probably the best team in the Sun Belt Conference. They're 26. They have 26 wins on the season. They're 12-4 in conference play. And you had them on the ropes. And you let them off. You just let them off. And that is the type of loss that's hard to come back from. It's easier if you're, say, LSU and you got punched in the mouth like they did by Florida, because after a few innings, you're just like, well, it wasn't our night, right? The other team, they're having an enormous time at the plate, and our pitching staff wasn't very good. It just wasn't our night. It wasn't meant to be. We got routed. Fine. When you have a four-run lead heading into the eighth inning on the road against one of the best teams in your conference, and your former ace turned bullpen stopper blows it with five runs, how do you bounce back from that? Like, if you're the Raging Cajuns, you're like, we did everything we were supposed to do. We racked up runs. We're on the road. And this doesn't fall squarely on Gunner's shoulders by any stretch of the imagination, because he still isn't right. Let's be honest. Gunner is not going to return to form this season. Anyone that's seen him pitch knows this. Anyone that watched him pitch 2 years ago and now sees him pitch now knows that he's not going to be the same. He's just not the same pitcher. The Cajuns will try to bounce back and try to put this heartbreaking loss behind them. Game two will be tonight. They're at UT Arlington, first pitch 6:30 p.m. We'll see if they can bounce back, take tonight's game, and then take the rubber match, hopefully, on Saturday at 2 p.m. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, Louisiana wrap-up time right here on 103.7 The Game.
Let's put the spotlight on the boot. It's time for the Louisiana wrap-up.
And welcome back to RP3 and Company, live inside the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. It's that time again, the Louisiana wrap-up.
Good Friday edition.
It is.
Good Friday.
It is a very good Friday edition, because we've got more than the normal three stops to make today. So let's dive right in. I got a full tank of gas, Ray, but it's not necessary because we're not going anywhere. We're starting right here, the heart of Acadiana in Lafayette.
UL softball, amazing season so far. They keep it going. Boy, it sure does feel like they're going to end up in Oklahoma, doesn't it, for the College World Series. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's talk about what they did last night. Last night, the number 10 ranked team in the country, rather, set the record for the best start in Sun Belt history, improving to 19-0 in league play, following a 10-2 six-inning win over Georgia State at Yvette Gerard Field there at Lampson Park. The Raging Cajuns are now 40-4 overall in the season, 19-0 in Sun Belt play, and they built that lead by methodically just getting after Georgia State, plating two runs in each of their first three at-bats. Julie Rawls would later put the game out of reach with her three-run home run in the fifth inning, which made it a 9-2 game. And also, Keely Milligan continued her march of greatness. She finished 2-of-2 with a pair of RBIs. It was her fifth multi-hit game in April. She also made headlines as she recorded three stolen bases to increase her season total to now 51, Cody. She joined Dorsey Steamer as the only individuals in Raging Cajun history to reach 50 stolen bases, and she matched Steamer's single-season stolen base record. The next stolen base, she'll have the record by herself.
And that'll probably happen tonight.
It'll probably happen in the first inning.
Right. Now, we're going to use that full tank of gas as we head down the old interstate to New Orleans. What you got for us in NOLA?
This kind of flew under the radar, and I apologize because I should have been more on top of this. But UNO head men's basketball coach Mark Schlesinger, friend of the show, was named the Louisiana Association of Basketball Coaches Major College Coach of the Year for the second time in 3 years. Schlesinger led the Privateers to a 19-14 overall record this year, 12-6 in the Southland, and the team reached the Southland Tourney Championship game. If you don't know, let me tell you, Mark Schlesinger, despite winning this award, he may be the most underrated coach in the entire state of Louisiana. This is a guy who learned under Mike McConathy for like a decade plus up at Northwestern State. He came to UNO when the program was in shambles. They had their memorabilia still soaked in a storage unit. They couldn't get kids. They flirted with being a D3 school for a year. And he somehow overcame all of that, built up the program slowly but surely, getting guys that fell through the cracks with other programs, and now he's winning Coach of the Year honors and has his team in contention of winning their conference championship year in and year out. Mark Schlesinger is a damn good coach, and he's loyal to UNO because they gave him his first gig. But if I'm one of these bigger schools, I'm going to be making a phone call down to the New Orleans area.
I mean, and he's got to take that phone call and then take that into consideration, because as much as you love a place like he might love UNO, and as much as he's done there, with the amount of talent that he seems to be able to bring into places, that there are bigger and better things on the horizon.
It always impresses me more, Cody, when I see a guy that gets guys that are not as talented but is able to develop those guys.
Right.
And if you're a coach and you can get the best out of someone who is not the most athletically gifted or talented player on the court, but you get them to achieve more than what maybe their body is even allowing, that tells me everything that I need to know about you and what type of coach you are.
Right.
And those guys are few and far between. He has done it year in and year out there down at UNO. So congratulations to Coach Schlesinger on receiving that prestigious honor.
It's kind of like Bill Belichick in the NFL. He takes these guys that just seem to be washed up, have nothing left, and then he can pull whatever little juice is left in them. He can pull it out of them.
I like that. I like that. That's a fair comparison, because, yeah, I mean, that's a guy that is notorious for just taking on people that, you know, other people are like, oh, we don't want to draft
him. Right.
Okay.
And then there you go, having Pro Bowl season.
And then Bill flips them into getting more draft picks, and then they go to that other team and they're hot garbage. But, yes.
How does he get them good on the field and value for it? It's impressive. Since we're in New Orleans, Ray, we might as well take a little trip across the border and head to Mississippi. Something went down in Hattiesburg. What do you got?
Well, Southern Miss has themselves a new basketball coach, and he's familiar to folks here in the state of Louisiana because his name is Jay Ladner, and he has been the head coach at Southeastern for the past 5 years. Why is this significant? Well, Ladner is a Hattiesburg native, but he has been at SLU for the past 5 seasons, and this is his destination job, but it's a big blow for the Southeastern Lions because this guy has been a very good coach with the Lions program. And I know, look, the level of competition in the Southland compared to even the Sun Belt or obviously the SEC, there's a vast difference there. I get that. But the guy has been able to win at a place like Southeastern, which is a difficult place. Not as difficult as UNO, okay? I understand that. But as you know, a former student,
yep,
with the Mighty Lions there. I call them Mighty. I just add the Mighty because I like to.
I think they are the Southeastern Mighty Lions.
Are they?
I think that's a thing.
That's not exactly the easiest place to coach and win at, but he's done a nice job. He turned the Lions into contenders in the Southland Conference over the last 2 years after dealing with scholarship reductions due to NCAA sanctions in his first 2 seasons, which had nothing to do with him. Okay, so if I'm Southern Miss, here's a guy that was handcuffed his first 2 years and still was able to turn them into a winner. His record is 76-88 at SLU. That's including those first 2 seasons where he had the scholarship reductions. Mm-hmm. But he led the Lions to a 22-win season and a conference championship and a trip to the NIT two seasons ago. So,
in my experience at Southeastern, and granted, this has been, you know, 7-8 years ago now, but in my experience, the majority of the money is poured into the baseball program at Southeastern, with whatever's left going to the football program.
That sounds about Strawberry Stadium. What up?
Strawberry Stadium is nice. I played in like sixth grade. We got to play like the Holy Ghost School, the middle school that's in Hammond. We got to play them at Strawberry Stadium.
Nice.
And it was fun, a little rubber. You know, when you're a kid and you get to play on the turf and everything,
it's a treat.
It was fun. But yeah, so just want to add that caveat to make it seem even more impressive because, you know, obviously Southeastern's not ignoring their basketball program. But again, the majority of their money goes to baseball, and whatever's left, I feel, goes to football. So that makes it even more impressive. He's doing that as at least the third highest program on campus.
Correct. And he returns back to Mississippi, where he spent 20 seasons as the head coach at a high school there in Bay St. Louis, where he compiled over 500 wins and won a state championship. He also won the Junior College National Championship back in 2014 as the head coach at Jones County Junior College, right there in Mississippi.
Not that long
ago. That's what helped land him the job at Southeastern. So now he's going back to Mississippi, got him a good gig. But congratulations to Coach Ladner on receiving his dream job there at Southern Miss.
Yes, sir. We got one more final stop to make, and this one is actually really cool for me because, you know, huge LSU fan. I also have some allegiances to the TCU Horned Frogs as well. So what do you say we make a little stop with a slash in the middle? Baton Rouge slash Fort Worth.
That's right. We're doing the slash Fort Worth for a reason. LSU senior gymnast Sarah Finnegan is the winner of the AAI Award, which is considered gymnastics' version of the Heisman Trophy.
Golden Spikes.
Or the Golden Spikes Award for baseball. Now, we say Fort Worth because we know LSU, a national prominent program, is in Fort Worth for the national championships, which begin today. Okay? But Sarah wins her sports version of the Heisman Trophy.
Is that at the American Airlines Center? Is that where that...
I believe so.
Where the Mavericks play? That would make
sense. I believe so.
Yeah.
The winner of this prestigious award is voted on by the nation's coaches and is considered the highest honor in women's gymnastics. Only seniors are eligible for the accolade. Finnegan joins Ashley Nant and Susan Jackson as LSU's winners of this award. In the moments after accepting the trophy, this is what I love. Finnegan took to Twitter and wrote, "We won the AAI award," and posting a picture with the whole team. You got to love that. And you got to love...
The journey's not over.
No, and I can guarantee you, D.D. Bro, Louisiana Sports Hall of Famer, longtime coach, face of that program, loves that as well. So, a tremendous honor for her. Hopefully, it won't just be the individual honor for the St. Louis, Missouri native. She does own the school record for beam titles in a season with 11 and a career record for beam titles with 27, as well as season all-around title wins with 13. She's also the two-time Southeastern Conference Gymnast of the Year and all-around champion. Got all the accolades. The only thing missing?
The natty title.
The natty title. Hopefully, Finnegan and the LSU gymnastics team will return home from Fort Worth this weekend with a national championship in tow. That's going to do it for this edition of the Louisiana Wrap-Up.
I mean, for Ms. Finnegan there, I feel like it is necessary and well-deserved to give her a real quick two claps and a Ric Flair.
Woo!
Well done, man. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you. When we come back, Ben Simmons proved one of his doubters wrong on the court, but did he actually prove him right? We'll dive into that right here on RP3 and Company on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. Good Friday edition. Good morning to you out there. Hope everyone was safe yesterday with the severe threat of weather that came through. Got a lot of rain at my house. It was far worse north of us. I know in the parishes north of Lafayette Parish, they experienced far worse weather. So if anyone had some trouble, we'll keep you in our thoughts. I do know there was tornado activity north of us yesterday.
You saw that picture. Man, there was somebody took a picture from the driver's seat of their car, and in their one, you know, cell phone picture, there were four tornadoes you could see in the one picture. Like, no, thank you.
It was scary.
I got in trouble yesterday because of the weather.
You got in trouble?
Well, last night when I went to sleep, I forgot to charge my phone. So the phone ran fine during the day, but just low battery most of the day. About halfway home, the phone died on me. When I got to the house, I was like, oh, I'll plug it in, charge it up, whatever. Without knowing that the wife had taken the charger that's at the house to work with her. I had no way to charge my phone until she got home from work. I was taking a nap on the couch. I got woke up with, well, I'm sure glad you're alive. God, I thought you were dead. You have no idea what you've been putting me through. You didn't answer your phone. I thought you were dead on silent. Rah, rah, rah. It was going straight to voicemail. I figured you were in some water and it died and you drowned. I was just like, oh my, where does your head go? How does that work? Like, oh, so I got in trouble yesterday. Because of the stupid weather.
I've received a similar conversation before. For not, why didn't you answer your phone? I was worried. Yet, when you do it the other way, well, I was working. Like, it doesn't work both ways. I'm just giving you the heads up now. A little bit of advice. If you don't answer your phone, right, then the world is literally ending.
Yo, no, the apocalypse hit yesterday in
the
my house.
The four horsemen are at your doorstep, and there's going to be hell to pay. Why didn't you answer your phone? I was worried. Something must have happened. I thought you had broken out. Yeah, I've gotten all that, too. But yet, when you call them, and they're, you know, in the grocery store or just, you know, hanging out with the kid.
Getting my hair done.
and then you're like, why didn't you answer? Well, I was busy. You can never use the I am busy with the wife. She can use it with you. You can never use it. Once again, tip number 13 to
yes.
you, Cody.
Yeah, Writing that one down, too.
Just to let you know. And every man listening right now is shaking his head going, that's correct. Yes, that's correct. So I have a question. If someone calls you out for not giving maximum effort, and calls you out for being average, and you go off on them the next time you face them, doesn't that prove their point? Like, here's my thing, in case you didn't know. So Jared Dudley, longtime veteran guy in the NBA, called out Ben Simmons before Game 3, said that he was an average half-court player. Was Jared Dudley wrong? No, he was not. Because Ben Simmons is an average half-court player. He also does not have a jump shot. It is 2019 in the NBA, and one of the stars, the key pieces for the Philadelphia 76ers, does not know how to shoot a jumper.
Yeah, that's Lonzo Ball's gimmick. You can't, come on, Ben, you can't steal
his thing.
Have
you watched the Golden State Warriors play basketball? That's all they do is shoot jumpers and three-pointers. You gotta be able to shoot the basketball. Ben Simmons, who we know for his brief layover, I want to say he probably had an extended stay at a motel during his time in Baton Rouge. He went off last night. Terrific game, 31 points, 11 of 13 from the field, 9 assists. Hell of a game, right? Terrific. But I'll say it again. He got called out by a guy, a veteran player in this league, Jared Dudley, who's known for just trying hard. The reason why Jared Dudley is still in the league as long as he's been is because of maximum effort. He is one of those cats that is stuck around in the NBA and has built up a career as a professional basketball player because of maximum effort.
I'm forgetting his first name, but Dellavedova. See him for a guy that's only in the NBA.
Because of effort.
Because of maximum effort.
Because of maximum.
He's the Deadpool of the NBA.
Not because of talent, but because of effort.
Not because of the height, build, anything like, no.
And then this veteran, well-respected veteran, calls you out. And you respond by giving maximum effort yourself and having one of your best games of your career. That's not how you win that argument. You're proving Dudley's point right there. Why the hell aren't you playing like that every night? A journeyman veteran calls you out, and then you respond by having a good game. Why isn't Ben Simmons doing that night in and night out? But this is the same question we asked about Ben Simmons. Yo boy, Cody.
Easy now.
Yo boy.
Easy now.
When he was at LSU. Immensely talented, naturally gifted ball player. No doubt about it. But you watched him play at LSU and you're like, wow, there's some nights where he just doesn't give a damn.
No, he cared less than Leonard Fournette.
True.
I mean, how well did that whole ordeal there work out?
And he's done the same thing at the next level. So, yeah, everyone's like, well, look how great Ben Simmons was last night in a playoff game. You're right. But he kind of played himself. Because
congratulations.
Congratulations. You just made Dudley's point for him.
Another one.
You are supposed to be an all-star franchise player, one of the young faces of this league. And you respond when Jared Dudley, a journeyman vet, calls you out by having your best game. That tells me everything I need to know and everything you need to know about the mental makeup and the mindset of Ben Simmons. He has to be goaded into having a stellar performance. He has to be called out by a journeyman to step up and have the type of game that we all feel he has the natural talent to have? For real? So, yeah, Ben Simmons can beat his chest all he wants. Terrific game. Good job in the playoffs. Why aren't you bringing that night in and night out? For real. Like, why aren't you doing that night in and night out? It's the same knock we had on him when he was at LSU, and it's the same thing he's doing in the pros. Sooner or later, Cody, either a guy has it or he doesn't. Your perfect player, your ideal player, has the natural talent and ability that Ben Simmons was born with and was cultivated over years. You take that, and then you take the hard work and the get-after-itness of a guy like Jarrett Dudley, and if you put them in the same body, in the same person, you have a Hall of Famer. That's the difference between a star player and a Hall of Famer. And I don't know if Ben Simmons has that mindset and that mental game to be a Hall of Famer. But he still has time. I just don't think it'll happen. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, we'll start off the second hour talking to Kyle Cormier, the head baseball coach at Brobridge High School, the number one ranked team in all of Class 4A.
Live and local, we are Acadiana's sports station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Raging Cajun legend Brian Mitchell.
My dream was always to play in the NFL, so having that opportunity was the main thing I needed.
LSU College World Series hero Warren Morris.
I don't get tired of talking about it. You know, if people remember me for that home run and winning that championship, I think that's great.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Welcome to the second hour of RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parsa III, here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. It's time for us to head out to the Artco Equipment Hotline as we welcome on today's first guest. He is the longtime head baseball coach at Brobridge High School. He's currently in his 19th season at the helm of the Tigers, his 24th overall, spending 5 years as an assistant coach. He was also an all-state football player at Brobridge High. He also played baseball. The two-sport star has turned into one of the more successful coaches in Acadiana. In his 19 years, he has led the Tigers to the state semifinals 4 times, including back-to-back years in 2016 and 17. This year, his ball club is ranked currently the number one team in the 4A power rankings. They're 27-3 overall, and they just wrapped up the District 5 4A championship. They will wrap up the regular season tonight at home versus Acadiana, first pitch at 6 p.m. It's our privilege to welcome onto the show Kyle Cormier. Coach, how are you this morning?
Doing great, man. Doing great. I appreciate you having me on.
Coach, appreciate you making some time for us. I know you were supposed to be wrapping up the regular season yesterday on Thursday, but all the severe weather that came through canceled the regular season finale between you guys and Acadiana. So you're going to play that tonight. That said, you guys are having a tremendous season, Coach. 27 wins on the year, only 3 losses. I know you're led by a veteran group of 4-year starters. That's Christian Gonzalez, your shortstop slash pitcher. Cole Mouton, your utility player and pitcher, who I do believe is 33-2 in his 4-year career for you there at Brobridge High. And then, of course, Noah Frederick, your starting center fielder. Tell me a little bit about this year's team and why you guys have been able to have so much success.
To be honest, coming into the year, we knew that we had the potential to have, some really good arms, a really good staff. Offensively, we lost 4 really, really good seniors last year, offensively and on the mound and defensively. And, we knew we had some big holes to fill with those guys. But, I thought that, potential wise that on the mound, I thought this would be the strongest staff I've ever had top to bottom. Now, I've had better guys, better arms, like 1 or 2 particular, but as far as 5 or 6 guys, I think we have 5 or 6 guys that, we can really, really count on, if the game's on the line.
At the high school level, Coach, I know how immensely difficult that is to have the depth in the rotation. Is that just something naturally that you and your staff have been able to develop over the past decade or so, is kind of building up these guys, putting a spotlight on a kid, saying, hey, this guy has a potential to be a pitcher for us down the road. Let's go ahead and start developing him now.
We work a lot of guys. Probably 90% of our team we work, pitching with. Now, obviously, not 90% of them are going to have the opportunity like others. But, we just, from the get-go, especially one kid we have, one senior, Gage Colligan. He was kind of a late bloomer, and we knew that. The other kids that were on staff, we had an idea from as freshmen, because they all helped us on the mound as freshmen. But this other kid, I had an idea that, by the time he got to be a senior, I thought he was going to have a lot of potential. And sure enough, he was a late bloomer, and he's a guy that's really helping us now. But the other guys that are part of our staff, they all pitched as freshmen for us on the varsity level. So we knew, they were very, very talented. We've just been real lucky, to be honest, to have, just really good players. I've been coaching long enough to know that I'm a better coach when we have better players. It's not rocket science. You got some guys that want to compete and, have some ability, and, you got a chance. That's the difference. If somebody tells you that, it doesn't take talent, they hadn't been in the coaching profession very long. You need talent to be able to win, but, obviously you got to go a little bit further. You got to have guys that are, willing to really work for each other. And we've been very fortunate, over the last 4 years, to have these guys. And now these seniors are, have played in the state tournament as freshmen and were big part of our team as freshmen, and now they've pretty much molded our team, these seniors have, to hopefully get us back to that spot again.
We're talking with head baseball coach at Brobridge High School, Kyle Cormier. Coach, let's talk a little bit about some of the other guys that may be some unsung heroes or guys that have really stepped up this season for you, in addition to who you've already mentioned, as well as those 4-year starters.
Sure. Those 4-year starters, like I said, have been, without a doubt, the nucleus of us over the last few years. It's going to be tough to replace 3 guys that have done so much for 4 years here. We might have had 1 or 2 guys in the past that have done, has created that type of impact, but to have 3 kids, consistently doing it for 4 years is pretty impressive. But also, someone on the mound has been, extremely consistent for us, Caleb Sorosky. He's a senior. He's another kid along with, Gonzalez that are both LSU e-commitments. And, he gives us a chance. When we're on the mound, I think defensively that might be our best defense, when he's on the mound, just because Gonzalez can play shortstop and Mouton can play
second, and Keegan Cormier can play third. You know, I think that's our strongest defense. Also, Keegan Cormier is a junior. You know, he's been, you know, very consistent for us on the mound as well. He's another one of our guys that, you know, we can really go to. He's another kid that played in the state tournament as a freshman. He's a 3-year starter now as a junior. You know, he's another, you know, big piece to our puzzle, you know, no doubt. And also, Leighton Bayard's another junior that, played for us last year, has a lot of experience in big games, and, you know, he's been hidden in the middle of our lineup as well. Also, our catcher, we had to, you know, he was in a really tough position because, 2 years ago and 3 years ago in 16 and 17, we had an all-state catcher, Tyler Thibodeau, who's now playing in Northwestern. And then last year, we had to replace him, which was going to be very tough, but we were lucky enough to have Julian Leon step in, and now he's currently at LSU Eunice also. So our catcher this year had some big shoes to fill, you know, with the guys that we had over the last 3 years. They were actually all-state, you know, for the last 3 years, our catchers. So, you know, he had big shoes to fill, but he's done an outstanding job, Gavin Corville, you know, really doing a good job with our pitchers and, you know, really being a wall for us, you know, behind the plate. And, you know, he's filled those shoes, you know, very well for us. And we're very lucky to have those guys.
Coach, player I definitely want to talk to you about, and I know you try not to put too much of the spotlight on him because – he's your son. That's the junior third baseman pitcher, Keegan Cormier, your son. He was only roughly 6 months old back in 2002 when you made it to the semifinals for the first time, and you've seen him grow up, and he's grown up around the program and the ballpark there at Breaux Bridge, and he's been a tremendous asset for you this year as well, manning the third baseman pitcher. How special has it been to be able to coach your own boy like that?
It's something that, you know, you really can't put a price on. And it's tough because, he gets the brunt of a lot of the frustration, you know, but, you know, his mom's tough on him just like I am. So it's, you know, he's used to it. And, that's something that I've done. I've been around him and was lucky enough to coach him in football, baseball, basketball since he was in T-ball. So, I've done it from the lower level all the way up to high school, and you know, there's no doubt that it's very special to see that, you know, to see him to succeed and to know how many games he's actually saw and been a part of, you know, throughout the years, in his 17 years of existence. And literally, you know, he's been at the ballpark since he was born, literally. So it's special. It's very special, and I'm just glad that you know, that he's able to contribute, you know, like others have in the past.
Coach, we'll wrap it up with this. We're talking to Coach Kyle Cormier, the head baseball coach at Breaux Bridge High School. His team, his Tigers, are currently ranked number one in the Class 4A power rankings, and they're 27-3 overall. They'll wrap up the regular season tonight at home versus Acadiana. First pitch at 6 o'clock. Coach, last year you guys were trying to make it to the state semifinals for the third year in a row. It ends in tough fashion there in the quarterfinals. How much has that defeat served as fuel for your program and for your guys, especially those seniors who want to go out with another trip to the semifinals and try to win a state championship?
To be honest, I think it has a lot. Last year it was we played Benton, and we talk about it, you know, a good bit. And on paper, they were a better ball club. They were a better hitting team than we were. I thought they were really, really talented. And after the Friday night game, they beat us up pretty good. But Saturday, you know, the type of team that we had and the type of kids that we had, when we came in to take BP Saturday morning, it was 100% business that, you know, the kids completely forgot about the Friday night. And, you know, they were going to do everything they could in their power to make it an interesting series. And there's no doubt it was the best series I've ever been associated with. And every fan that was there would say the same thing, that they was worth every cent. We actually went extra innings the Saturday in both games, went 11 innings and 9 innings. And we beat them 5-3, and they beat us 5-3 in the end. And we had many opportunities to win the ball game. But, you know, for the kids to fight back the way they did, I mean, I've never been associated with something as special as that. Even though, you know, for someone that was there, even though we did lose the game, you know, I felt that we won just because, you know, the amount of fight that the kids showed for each other. And, you know, they literally left everything out on the field. And, you know, as a coach, from doing it so long, you know, a lot of people get caught up in the wins and losses and whatnot. And, you know, I was so proud just because, you know, the kids were, they didn't back down. You know, they fought for each other. And, you know, win, lose, or draw, I was extremely proud of, you know, the effort that they showed for each other. And I couldn't ask for anything more, to be honest. So, yes, it did fuel because they hurt. And they tasted, you know, what it feels like to be in the state tournament. And they were so close to doing it 3 years in a row. Benton ended up winning the whole thing. So I think it was kind of meant to be for them because they lost in the quarters 5 years in a row prior to that. So I think it was just their time. But, you know, these kids are, you know, they're hungry to get back. They know what it takes. And the seniors have led us, you know, in this position. And we're excited. We're extremely excited for the opportunity.
Well, Coach, I appreciate you making some time for us. Best of luck tonight. And best of luck when the playoff pairings come out and you guys make a trip, hopefully, back to the state semifinals and beyond. Thank you so much, Coach.
Thank you very much for having us. Appreciate it.
That's Brobridge head baseball coach Kyle Cormier joining us here on RP3 and Company. We got to take a break. Coming up later this hour, though, our boy Barry Hurstis is going to join us at 7:32, so make sure to stay tuned for that. Right here on 103.7 The Game. LSU, it took you long enough. Joe Oliva is no longer the athletic director or athletics director or director of athletics or whatever terminology you want to use, because there's been three different ways I've seen it out there. He's gone. What took you so damn long? For real. If anyone else was this incompetent in their job, they would have been fired. And it would have taken 11 years to do so. The man should have been shown the door when it came to the Les Miles situation. That should have been everything that they needed to say, you know what, Joe? Hit the road. But it wasn't. This man wanted to fire the head football coach at LSU, a national championship winning head coach. He was in every right to do so because the program had fallen on harder times. It was losing the arms race with recruiting when it was compared to Alabama. It was losing in the aspect of modern coaching and modern coaching philosophies, particularly on offense. And the groundswell of support for Coach Miles is expected, because anytime someone is being forced out or being removed from a position, you're always going to have those people that get nostalgic and they go, oh, we love Uncle Lester. Oh, yeah, he shouldn't be fired. We love him. He's the best coach LSU's ever had.
If you don't count Nick Saban, that might be true.
Thank you. And all this happened. And what did Joe do? Instead of doing the right thing and getting rid of Les then, he cowered to public perception and the national media from the four-letter network chiming in and going, well, how can you get rid of a national championship-winning coach? That's no loyalty and blah, 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 blah. All the talking heads got after him and the university. Folks in Baton Rouge and across the state did the same thing. And during the regular season finale, which I'm still struggling to wrap my head around, he makes the decision during the game that, no, I want to keep this coach now instead. For beating Texas A&M and Kevin Sumlin? Are you huffing paint thinner? Like, for real? Les Miles gets carried off. Last regular season game. Thanks for the memories, coach. No, our bad. We still want you around. That alone, right there. The president of the university said, that's enough. You just embarrassed us. That's enough. Now, what really happened is not only was there a groundswell of support and national media chiming in and the local fan base chiming in and possibly Governor Bobby Jindal making a stink about doing the buyout with Les Miles because the state was going through an economic hardship, which it still is. The real reason is because he tried to get Jimbo to come back to LSU, a wildly popular offensive coordinator on a national championship team, and tried to woo him away from Florida State. Jimbo was never coming to LSU. Never. He was in Tallahassee for a reason. He's at A&M for a reason. And Joe Oliva got played, and it got leaked out that he got played. And then, so he, instead of just manning up and going, we're still getting rid of our coach, no, I didn't get Jimbo Fisher, instead of just denying those reports and saying we're still going into a different direction because our program needs to go into a different direction, he cowered. And that, right there, he should have been let go in that moment. But that didn't happen. Instead, they kept Les Miles. And instead, Les Miles promised that he was going to change and that Cam Cameron was going to be more inventive on offense. And then three games into the next season, that proved to be otherwise. And Les Miles was fired. And you embarrass the program once again with your actions. You don't fire a coach in the middle of the season. You don't fire a national championship winning coach in the middle of the damn season either. If you got any sense. This guy's supposed to be smart. Like, he has the type of degrees that they don't even let your boy, RP3, even walk on campus to get, okay? Like, they're no. We've seen your qualifications. We know what your ACT score is. No, sorry. Move along. You can go work down at the restaurant that serves us food every lunch. No. Okay? This is supposed to be a smart guy. That is a big dummy move. Like, that's your big dummy. So, he mishandles that. He mishandled everything with the football program. His basketball hires, and particularly the women's basketball hires, have been dreadful. The women's basketball program under Joe Oliva's watch has become the epitome of mediocre. Baseball has been stellar, but guess what? He didn't hire Maneri. Skip Bertman did. Remember that. And he has a chance to hire, to bring in a big-name coach. He doesn't. Tom Herman plays him just like Jimbo did, and he has to settle for Ed Orgeron. And that's what he did. He settled for Ed O. I like Ed O. I agree with Ron Higgins, who came on the program earlier this week. I like Ed O as the coach of LSU. I think he's the right guy at the right moment. But once again, embarrassed then. And then the whole Will Wade drama situation. And the guy's not even, like, you suspend him indefinitely, and there's possibly a very considerable chance that nothing is going to come of this. And you embarrassed yourself before. But this is my point. LSU, this falls on you. You let Joe Oliva be a public relations nightmare for your university, for your athletic department, not only throughout the state of Louisiana, but for the nation. And you should have known better when you hired him 11 plus years ago, because he is the same guy who sullied the name and made a rash judgment with the Duke lacrosse case that proved to be that there was, in fact, no sexual assault and no rape, but yet ruined the career of the head coach there and tarnished those players at Duke. And this guy got away with doing that and was nearly fired because of it at Duke. And LSU's like, hey, come on over. What'd you think was going to happen when you hired Joe Oliva nearly a dozen years ago? You get what you deserve sometimes. The new guy, I'm really high on. But Joe Oliva era has come to an end. But it should came to an end 5 years ago. It should have never happened to begin with. What are you thinking? What were you thinking? I'm all worked up now. My cholesterol is up to. RP3 and Company, 103.7 Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game. I am Raymond Parch III, a.k.a. RP3, your host. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. It's time now for us to head back out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline as we welcome on our next guest. He is a contributor for the Saints News Network and Big Easy Magazine. He is our boy Barry, the one and only Barry Hurstis. How are you doing this morning, Barry?
I'm doing fine, RP3, and yourself?
I'm doing very well. Let's get right to it, my friend. The schedule was officially released. We already knew who the home teams were going to be and the away teams were going to be, but we didn't know what the order was going to be. Saints get not one, not two, but four primetime games. Your thoughts on the NFL making sure that the Saints and the Houdat Nation got a lot of pub on the TV in primetime?
I think that it was their way of showing us a little love, maybe, perhaps, for the way things ended at the end of January. Not saying that's why, but sure sounds like that inspired it, perhaps. So, and look, I mean, you know, what, a 13-3 football team that's, by all accounts, should be the defending NFC champions. Certainly, they deserve the recognition. So, I'm glad to see that they'll that they'll be in prime time. And then, of course, you know, you got several games that are actually will be nationally televised as well. I would imagine, obviously, the Rams would be the 3 o'clock national game that week. And when they play Chicago at Soldier Field in week seven, obviously that's probably going to be a nationally televised game by Fox Sports as well. So even though they're in prime time four times, they'll be nationally televised probably, I would say, seven, possibly even eight times. So, well-deserved.
And then, obviously, one of those four games you mentioned, you know, they start off Monday Night Football. First Monday Night Football game of the season is going to feature the Saints at home versus the Houston Texans. I'm pumped up about that game. And then it's the and then it's the West Coast road trip with Seattle and the Rams. And then back home with the Cowboys, which is the Sunday night game. You also get appears to be a Sunday night game against the Indianapolis Colts, which I was a little surprised by. I know it's the 10-year anniversary of the Super Bowl between the two teams, but I was kind of surprised a late-season game between the Colts and the Saints would get that kind of love. Anything about the schedule that stood out to you, Barry, or that was just curious?
Well, just that they've, once again, they're going to have a good start. You know, we've documented well in the past that the Saints have gotten off to a poor start in their first few games the last few years. Now, to their credit, they've been able to overcome it the last two seasons and wind up, you know, winning back-to-back division titles and almost going to the Super Bowl for two straight years. So it hasn't been a detriment to them in more recent times, and I think that's a direct reflection of the roster, obviously, and the talent level having greatly improved through the last few drafts. That said, I think they need to go 2-2 in those first four games. I mean, you know, Texans and Cowboys at home, those are no slouches, man. Those are both teams that were in the playoffs last year. So I think realistically, they'd be happy with a split of those first four games. If you split the two at home and split the two on, they're talking about even staying out on the West Coast after they play the Rams, because then they got to fly right back out to Seattle. So it almost doesn't make sense to fly back. You might as well just stay out there and maybe find a team willing to share a practice facility or something somewhere, or a university that they may have a relationship with where they can train, you know, for the better part of that week. So that stands out. And then, of course, what I refer to as the November NFC South gauntlet, because you're going to be playing Atlanta, Carolina, Tampa Bay, and then Atlanta again for the whole month of November. So the entire month of November, the NFC South division basically could be determined within those 4 weeks, especially if the Saints, let's say, they win three out of four. That, to me, is a critical stretch of their season. Having the Colts, even the 49ers, if Garoppolo is recovered, could be a tough game, you know. So there'll be a few interesting tests there at the end, towards the very end of the season. But for me, it's the first four games and the entire month of November. If you come out of that stretch, let's say 5-3 in those four games, I think that realistically that they could pull that off, and that'll put them in the playoffs for a third straight year. I expect nothing less from this team. Again, as you and I have discussed in previous weeks, they don't have to do much, and I'm sure we'll get to the draft in a minute, but there's not much more for this team to do other than just try to maintain what they've already had, maybe make a few tweaks here and there, and just go all in on the 2019 season, because, again, as you and I have discussed previously, it's all about Drew Brees now. To me, their quote-unquote window of opportunity is closing by the minute. I really feel like there's maybe two, possibly three seasons left for them to pull this off. My feeling is they'd like to do it this coming season, especially with everything that's happened in the past 2 years. So hopefully they'll be able to accomplish that.
We're talking to Barry Herstis, contributor for the Saints News Network, as well as Big Easy Magazine. Barry, one more question about the schedule, and then we'll switch over to draft. The Atlanta Falcons thought they were getting cute with they released this very high-end produced schedule release video, kind of a Game of Thrones-inspired thing, where they throw shade at the Saints, refer to them as the Aints, and then they had a Saint get rammed by an actual ram, get knocked down by a ram, and a ref comes in and then says there's no call. So they throw shade at the Saints for that. Should a team that blew a 25-point lead in the Super Bowl really be throwing shade at a division rival?
No, absolutely not. They should not. But then again, this is probably one of the more heated rivalries in professional sports. I ain't just talking about the NFL or NBA or college football. We're talking all of professional sports. When it comes to the Saints fans and Falcons fans, it can be brutal. And look, I give them props. Seriously, I give them props. It was well done. I'm sure it obviously played well with the Falcons fan base. If you're on Twitter, you know the Falcons fans are loving it and trying to rub it in the Saints fans' faces every chance they get. So, look, kudos to them. Again, I thought it was well done. It was a great troll job. That said, when your team, can't get over that hump and infamously blew a 25-point lead in the Super Bowl, and the team you're making fun of does have a Super Bowl title under their belt and, has gone deep and made two deep playoff runs in the last two seasons, you probably shouldn't be talking a whole lot of smack. But, hey, that's fine. That's fine because, man, you talk about some really interesting games. What is that, November 3rd, I think it is, and then Thanksgiving night? Buddy, it ain't going to be pretty.
Barry, let's talk a little bit about the draft. It's kind of quiet right now, and it usually is this time of the year, the week heading in. Mm-hmm. All the big people are doing their mock drafts and going through scenarios and everything like that. Do you believe when the draft occurs, well, it'll be the second round a week from today. First round will be a week from yesterday. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's going to be a way, whether it's Andres Pete being traded or a future pick being traded, do you believe that the Saints will find a way to be in Thursday night's first round?
I think they're seriously considering it. I don't want to go out on a limb and say for sure that they are, because you never know with the Saints. But again, I can't stress enough, John Gruden is back in coaching, and the relationship between him and Peyton is famous. They're very good friends. And just because the Raiders are in the middle of a rebuild, hey, there's a good chance they might want a guy like Andres Pete. We don't know. We probably won't know unless they make a deal prior to Thursday, or if they just happen to make it the night of, which is the more likely scenario.
Right.
Would it shock me? No. But that said, I almost get the feeling that they're leaning towards staying with what they have and just taking the best, the dreaded BPA, the best player available at number 62.
But that doesn't mean that they won't be making some wheels and deals, right? I mean, they could wait till the second day.
They could wait till the second day and get something
for Andrus Peat or whatever. It could be another second round and a third rounder, right?
Oh, yes, sir. Absolutely. And then also, let's remember, Alvin Kamara, third round pick. They had a trade. They had to make a trade with the Bears and the 49ers just to pull that pick off, you know. And now here we are, two and a half years later, and Alvin Kamara is one of the best running backs in football. So I totally agree. It doesn't mean that they have to get in the first round, as you alluded to. They could just pick up another second or third. And I believe it was Daniel Jeremiah of NFL Network, and I know you're going to have Mike Dettillier on after me, and you could probably ask him the same question, which is, you know, the talent between, I would say, probably the first 25 players. I don't know if Mike Dettillier will agree with this, my assessment, but from 25 down to 62 where the Saints are picking, it's pretty even. I mean, your best players are 1 through 25. And then from 25, say maybe all the way down to 70, it's a crapshoot. You could flip a coin on a lot of these guys. So could I see them, you know, maybe approaching Gruden and the Raiders and say, look, Andrus Peat, give you a solid starter at left guard for the next 5 years. You never know. That's all I'm saying. You know, again, I don't want to go out on a limb and say something and be completely wrong, which I have many times. But certainly it's not out of the question. And given the past history of Peyton and Loomis, you almost expect it.
We're on with Barry Hurstis of the Saints News Network and Big Easy Magazine. Barry, we've talked a lot on this program with you, and a lot of people have talked about wide receiver, wide receiver, wide receiver, defensive line, defensive line, defensive line. That's what they're going to approach. They're going to go after a tight end as well. That's all you hear, wide receiver, D-line, tight end. Would you be stunned, though, on a week from today when you are going to be in Nashville covering the draft that the Saints pick is an offensive lineman?
Nah, not at all. Would not shock me. And one that could play center. Because I really think they're looking for a guy who's versatile, who can play guard, tackle, and maybe even center. You already have a guy on the roster that can do all three, which is Will Clapp, the pick from last year that played at LSU. So, but it would not shock me if it was a lineman. And also, don't be shocked if they went cornerback. I know they're set at corner pretty much. They feel like they've, you know, you got Lattimore on that one outside position. You got Apple on the other outside position. Now you got P.J. Williams coming back to play the slot. But, you know, for me, outside of those three guys, I'm not sure that they couldn't stand to use a little more additional depth at cornerback. So don't be shocked even if cornerback wound up being the pick. The only thing I think we can rule out at this point is that it obviously won't be a running back, and I don't think it'll be a defensive tackle. And I wouldn't rule out an edge rusher, a pass rusher, just because they lost Okafor and essentially haven't replaced him, quote unquote, so to speak. So I think an edge rusher could come in there, not necessarily in the second round, though. I mean, you got an underrated kid like Malik Reed of the University of Nevada that could be available to them when they get on the clock in the fifth round. So this is a deep draft. It's weak in some areas. Obviously, quarterback is probably not the year to draft a quarterback unless you're in the top five picks, basically. But, you know, other than that, I mean, it's wide open. I literally can see the Saints getting on the clock with that pick and looking at their draft board, and whoever's the highest rated guy, regardless of position, and they'll make that pick. That's actually what they did with Peat a few years ago. So wouldn't shock me at all if they went that route again.
Barry, wrap it up with this, brother. I know you're going to enjoy yourself in Nashville. Who it'd be difficult not to enjoy yourself in Nashville. I had a great time when I went up there for the SEC tournament. That said, I know you're going to have a good time. Are Saints fans going to be happy after the draft weekend on what the Saints have done, either via trades or with their picks?
No, because perpetually they're unhappy. They're unhappy about everything. This fan base will not be, what's the term, a queasiest until they win the Super Bowl. Look, there's a big time chip on the shoulder of the franchise, of the organization, and definitely a big time chip on the shoulders of the fan base. Even a chip on the shoulder of journalists that cover the team that are from New Orleans, like myself. So look, will they be happy? No, unless they trade into the first round and get an a player with all pro caliber potential or something. No, I just don't think they'll be. They weren't happy with the Davenport pick last year, and I think Davenport's going to be a phenomenal player. So we'll see how it turns out. They might make a surprise pick here or there, especially if they get a kid like Foster Moreau of LSU to be the backup tight end and perhaps groom him as tight end in the future after Jared Cook leaves. So there's some, depending on who they pick, I could see some Saints fans getting pretty excited. But for the most part, nah, they won't be happy. They're never happy.
Barry, appreciate you, brother. Be safe going to Nashville next week. We'll talk to you live from Nashville next Friday, my friend.
RP3, I enjoyed it and looking forward to it.
That's our boy, Barry. Barry Hurstis of the Saints News Network and Big Easy Magazine, breaking down all things Saints for us. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, we'll wrap up the second hour of this Good Friday edition right here on 103.7 The Game. Oh, I did. I did the Run DMC
version. You were waiting
version.
For the Run DMC.
Oh, I was
to
waiting
come
for the scratch. I was waiting.
I saw you. That was really funny.
I love both. I was raised on Aerosmith, but then like I hear that song, I always think of the version with Run DMC.
He did the whole record scratch with his head. Nowhere to be found.
Nowhere to be found. That's all right though. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on this Good Friday edition on 103.7 The Game. Hey man. If you're up and you want to talk sports, give us a call on the Arco Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. Coming up to start off the third hour, will we have the one and only, the draft guru himself, Louisiana's own Mike Dettillier, will be joining us at 8:02. And then we'll have Tyler Nunez, a Tiger Rag, giving us some more LSU talk at 8:32. So you got a little time to talk to us here in this segment. Houston Astros get back on the diamond tonight for a three-game series against their rivals, the Tejas Rangers. They're at the ballpark at Arlington. I don't care what it's called, Cody. I know that's not what it's called. That's what I'm calling it.
Call it Citibank.
That's what I'm calling it.
I don't remember, but it's dumb.
The ballpark at Arlington is what I'm calling it. Three-game set. Astros are in the first place in the AL West. Tonight's first pitch will be at 7:05. Saturday's game two will be at 7:05, and first pitch on Sunday will be 2:00. Now, you can listen to Stros tonight and tomorrow on our sister station, The Rewind, 97.7 FM, 1330 AM Lafayette, also 104.1 in Lake Charles. So, Astros will be on KVOL tonight and tomorrow, and then on Sunday, the Stros will be broadcast live right here on 103.7 The Game on Easter Sunday. First pitch, 2:00. So, got to make sure to check out the Stros, who, after the early season slump, when everyone thought the sky was falling, Justin Verlander has the terrific start in the season opener against the artist formerly known as the Devil Rays. Then they lost three straight, and then they got roughed up by the Rangers. But then they swept the Yankees for the first time, and then after that, they have been on straight fire, 10-game winning streak. They lost the other night to Oakland. They'll have a little bit of a bad taste in their mouth. We talked about this with James Yasko yesterday. This is not the team that the Rangers want to face, an angry Astros team. But Houston, I expect them to go in there and at least take 2 of 3 from the Rangers starting tonight. Once again, Astros baseball. You can listen to it live tonight on KVOL 97.7 FM 1330 AM right here in Lafayette. Or on 104.1 in Lake Charles. When we come back, We'll talk to the draft guru himself, the one and only Mike Dettelier, will be joining us here on RP3 and Company on 103.7 The Game.
Live and local, we are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Raging Cajun legend Brian Mitchell.
My dream was always to play in the NFL, so having that opportunity was the main thing I needed.
LSU College World Series hero Warren Morris.
I don't get tired of talking about it. You know, if people remember me for that home run and winning that championship, I think that's great.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Welcome to the third and final hour of RP3 and Company on this Good Friday here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. And it's our privilege now to go out back out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline to welcome on our next guest. He's the longtime college and pro football analyst for WWL Radio in New Orleans. He is Louisiana's own draft expert, known for his draft report, which is right now on the desk here in the studio. I've been thumbing through it for an entire week. Cody can attest to that. It's the one and only Mike Dettelier. Mike, how are you this morning, brother?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
Mike, appreciate you coming on, making some time for us, man. The draft is less than a week away now, and I just wanted to kind of touch base with you on some things that I saw going on for the draft, and we'll talk about the Saints, and we'll talk about LSU, but let's start off with the Tigers. They have two guys that look to be locks for the first round. Devin White, for sure. You have him graded extremely high, the number one inside backer. In your draft report, Greedy Williams is also, you gave a first-round grade, the highest cornerback on the board. But I'm going to ask you, Mike, I've seen in the last couple weeks that some people have him as a mid-round, first-round pick. Some people have him going in the second. Why the fluctuation on a guy that's so talented?
Well, you know, it's that time of year. Everybody's got different opinions on a player.
Right.
So you're going to get that about a lot of guys from 20 to 35 today, to be honest. But, you know, watching Greedy, you know, it didn't take me 2 years like some of the national guys to figure out he's not a good tackler. I mean, you know, listen, I can see that from game one. It's not his forte, and he knows it. Talk to him about it, and he's told me I want to get better in that area. I need to get stronger. I need to do a better job as a wrap-up tackler. But on the other hand, you take a look at his size, his great length. He's got something I can't teach, and that's ball skills. You know, as a coach, you can't teach that. Either you have it or you don't. And he finds the ball real quickly in flight. He's got tremendous foot speed. And again, you look where he played. It's a school that's produced a lot of defensive backs. So, you know, everybody's trying to promote their own guy. And I hate to bang the drum on this, but listen, there's a lot of agents that get into the ear of some of these national guys. Because they try to get in mind. But, you know, I've been married for over 30 years, so I know how that is. You can sort of tune that out after a while. But that's part of it. That's part of what you see a lot of times from national guys that, oh, listen, I got DeAndre Baker. Let me tell you how good he is. And Byron Murphy, let me tell you how good he is. Rakan Singh, let me tell you how good. So, you know, after you hear it enough times, you start believing it yourself. And you got to believe what your eyes tell you. And from a matchup standpoint, Greedy's got all the skills you're looking for as a cover corner. Everybody's got a flaw, you know, no matter what. And for Greedy, it's certainly in the run support area of the game. But, man, he's special talent as far as a cover guy, because in this league full of huge wideouts, he matches up well downfield. And that's a big key for me. When you see all these king size receivers hitting the NFL left and right, you better be able to match up. And Greedy can do that very well. And he's got a little bit of athletic arrogance to him, and I like that. That he really doesn't think anybody's going to beat him. And if they do, well, you know what? I'll come back the next time and I'll make you pay the price.
We're on with Mike Dettelier. He is the man behind the Mike Dettelier's Draft Report, one of the most respected draft guides in the business. He's also the college and pro football analyst for WWL Radio. Mike, tell me a little bit about Foster Moreau. You have him as the eighth best tight end in this class. You grade him as a second to third round guy. This is a guy that's increased his draft stock every step of the way, right? From the Reese's Senior Bowl to the Combine to the Pro Day. He's done everything right along the way to increase his draft stock. What are some of the things that he really brings to the table that NFL teams are going to like?
Well, he's helped his draft stock, actually, from the start of his senior season all the way through. We all knew Foster could block because, you know, that's why they brought him in. He's got a great story. His mom was a terrific volleyball player at Tulane. He almost went there. He had a verbal commitment to go to Tulane, and then at the last minute, LSU had a scholarship opening, and he ended up, you know, going to LSU instead. Great size guy. He's a big man. When Les recruited him, you know, those tight ends are blockers, like another tackle. And that didn't change a lot. The last 2 years, he's caught 46 passes at LSU, which is solid. But that's not what he was used a lot at. And you looked at LSU's tackles. you needed some help. Because Joe Burrow's got the best aerial views of stadiums across the Southeast. And so they kept Foster in a lot to help out as a blocker. But he's real competent as a receiver. He's a big target. I think in the NFL, short yardage, red zone, he's going to be a really good player. And what I see today, this is one of the better tight end classes I've ever done. It would rival, and I've done this 33 years, so it would rival most of the top classes. But today's spread offense, you rarely see a tight end used as a blocker, as an inline blocker. They're flanked out like a receiver. That's not the case with Foster. So he brings that element to the table with you. He worked out with a track coach, and it really helped him out. His flexibility is he was a fast player before, but, you know, it helped him out to better that part of the game with him. And so I think he's a guy third round, maybe very early fourth, but I think third round for him. It's going to be where he gets selected at. And just you talk about a competitor. He got the ultimate compliment. You know, Coach and I, we've known each other now over 40 years. Both grew up on the Bayou, went to different schools, but both grew up on the Bayou. And I asked him one time, we did a Tiger tour together, and I said, you know, what about Foster? And he said, Mike, let me tell you, if you all wouldn't know no better, it's ways from the Bayou, man. He's tough. That Jesuit stuff, he's tough. And that's the ultimate compliment from Ogeron, when you get a tough comment come from him. And so I think he's a guy that's really went from a late-round pick to start the season to a middle-round pick. And that's a pretty big jump. But, you know, the accumulation of his work. Also, too, when things started to spiral for LSU in the summer, a lot of quarterback controversy, players getting in trouble, suspensions, that sort of thing. Foster was one of the guys in the locker room that kind of took control and said, wait a minute, you know, all this stuff ain't affecting us. You know, we're going to go out and take care of business. And whatever happens with somebody, you know, hey, look, that's your personal deal, but it's not going to affect this locker room. And he sort of took control of it, along with Devin. And I got a lot of respect for a guy because you know what? A lot of people talk about leadership but don't do a damn thing about it. And he was a guy that did something about it. He called that team meeting in, and he got those guys to say, hey, listen, we can't do anything about what's happening off the field. Well, we can take care of business on the field.
Talking to Mike DeTillier, draft expert. Mike, I want to talk about the Ferguson brothers, if you don't mind. Jazz obviously started his career off there at LSU and then rewrote all the record books at Northwestern State last year, the big body wide receiver. You have him as a third to fourth round guy. His brother, Jalen, is the NCAA all-time sack leader from Louisiana Tech. You have him as a late first, early second round. I know teams are very high on both brothers. In your opinion, what makes Jazz so good at the next level? And do you think he's going to be kind of a steal because he went to Northwestern State?
Well, with Jazz, you know, I saw him play a lot in high school. And, man, he was a dominating player there because of his size. Just a big body receiver. He will even admit to this. He was a little bit of a knucklehead early on in his career at LSU. He got into a little bit of trouble. He wasn't a real focused player. And everybody matures a little bit differently in life. And, he decided to leave, go to Northwestern, and you're right, he had a signature year last year. Just a big receiver. I mean, and I'm talking about a big body receiver. A huge frame, long arms, catches the ball well out front with his hands. He's going to need a little bit of work as a route runner, a little bit more refined, because a lot of times he sort of rounds off his routes. But, man, I like the skill set of Jazz in that he's become more focused. He understands he ain't on scholarship anymore, is the real McCoy. And he really pieced it together last year at Northwestern State. And I was proud of him what he did because you wondered a little bit that he was a potential guy. But he turned that potential into production last year for Northwestern State. And he's caught the eyes of the scouts. And again, it's the matchup. He got a 6'4" plus receiver who could run like Jazz can. And you get him in that short yardage red zone area of the field and jump ball situations. I didn't go to Cornell or Harvard or Yale, but I do know a 6'4.5" receiver going up against a 5'10" corner. If I put the ball up high enough, I know who will win. That's not a real sharp one on that, but he's made a lot of progress, and I've gotten a lot of calls about Jazz, to be honest with you, from guys that sort of double check the Southern players, and there's a host of teams that are very interested in Jazz. Jalen's a little bit different. In that Jalen came out, he had a problem. I probably had too, because he couldn't pick up weight. He was a 210, 212-pound guy coming out of West Feliciana, and he just couldn't pick up any weight. He wasn't a widely recruited guy, but then late in the process, you had some SEC schools run after him, Ole Miss, Mississippi State, Missouri, and some of the Texas schools also had a lot of interest late. LSU was not one of them, even though basically he's in their backyard. So he goes to Tech and, has the red shirt and puts on a little bit of weight. But what you saw with him, he's been dominating coming off the edge. He can turn the corner real quickly. He's got a good beat on the quarterback. He's learned how to use his arms and hands much better as a technician. And he's relentless. He stays after you. He's had some off-the-field issues a little. But I don't think that's a major thing with Jalen. And, again, he's a young man that has become a more mature, more focused player. And you can tell with his play out in the field, he breaks Terrell Suggs' FBS pass record. So, man, he's put up some big numbers there. And every week, if I'm playing Tech, it don't take a rocket scientist to figure out, man, I got to slow him down. So he's getting chipped. He's getting a tight end put on him. He's getting a back sort of taking him out. Where he's going to have to improve a little bit more is in run support. And a lot of times he's so focused on getting into the backfield, he'll get up the field and he sort of leaves his area open and teams will run in that spot. But, man, he can rush a quarterback. And that is gold in the NFL if you've got that type player. And I think he still has some upside to his game. And so with him, he's going to need to improve his lower body power. Now, I told him it's something Danielle Hunter told me when he left LSU, that he felt as though he was so close on plays, but he just didn't make them. And he got much stronger in the lower body. That fuels the fire. You know, it fuels you, that lower body power. And that's something he's going to have to work on a little bit more, but I like him a lot. And I think he's a late first, early second-round pick.
Mike, I want to ask you about the Saints. Obviously, they do not have a first-round pick, but Mickey Loomis and Jeff Ireland are known to be wheeling and dealing. They do have the second-round pick, and then, again, they have a lot of late-round guys, fifth and sixth round. Let me ask you this to start off with. Do you believe that they're going to stay pat where they're at, or do you think they're going to move around either by trading someone like Andres Pete or trading future picks to get back into maybe the first round or another second round pick this year?
Well, I can read a racing form. I just go back to a few years back. Sean Payton wanted Mark Ingram, and they traded up in the round one to get him. He wanted Brandon Cooks. They traded up in round one to get him. He wanted David Onyemata. They traded up in the fourth round to get him. He fell head over heels for Alvin Kamara, and he traded up in the third round to get him. Last year, he wanted Marcus Davenport, traded up in round one to get him. So, you know, if I'm going to the track and I look at that, I would say they ain't going to stay pat. It's just a part of a pattern. And, you know, I think early on, especially, you know, and Sean's admitted this, hey, you know, the top 110 players, you know, I know them really well. It's the guys beyond there. I got to rely on my scouts and scouting department to give me the best information there. But early on, Sean's always sort of fallen in love with a player or two. And I sort of have the feeling the same thing will happen this year. And it may not be going into round one back again, but it could well be that that's a long stretch not having a third or fourth round pick that, you know, he decides to deal off a future pick to move up to get a selection either in round three or round four. So, yeah, I think he's going to be aggressive in doing so. And then, you know, for the Saints, and they got to fall back into a spot where your scouting department's got to take over. Because once you get past the third round, that's where your scouting department and your regional scouts play such a huge part in this. And, you know, Sean always has a comment, and he's told me this, that, you know, I tell my scouts, you know, don't go tell anybody else when this is all over with, you know, I beat the table for a guy. You tell me first. Tell me now if you want this player and you think he'd be a good fit with us. And, you know, if you're wrong, you're wrong. But, you know, don't go tell, you know, the media people afterwards, you know, I lobbied for this guy, but, you know, you didn't want him. So I think he's much better listening to the scouts today than maybe before. And you got to rely on those guys because they've seen him, you know, for, you know, 2 years, 3 years, whatever. Today you rarely get a four-year guy, but it's part of the game today that you've got to have some trust. And the other part is, and he sort of emphasizes this, that you got to have a vision of how you're going to use that player offensively, defensively, or on special teams. And they've done a much better job, I think, throughout the years in finding out a little bit more about the mental makeup of a player, of the more focused player and somebody that football matters to them. Most of us can see if a guy's got talent or not. It's the intangible part of the game, how much you want to work at it, how coachable you are, that sort of thing. So I think Jeff has brought in a buffer there where if he sees a player and maybe, you know, there's some division there. Because, you know, you put 10 scouts in a room, you're going to get 10 different opinions. You throw in a coach, then that's 14 different opinions from 11 guys. Because the coach, he's all over the board. I live next to a former NFL coach. And he's told me before, coaches are the worst talent evaluators in the world. So, and he was one of them. Believe me, he was one of them. Because he thought he could coach anybody. So you fall into that. But I do think that they're going to be aggressive. It's been part of the makeup of this football team over the last 5 or 6, 7 years, where it's not the George Allen philosophy of the future is now, but it's got some of the remnants of that, understanding that the only championship you can play for is the one you're playing for this year. Man, you know, who wants to hear about 2021 or 2022? Man, listen, I'm worried about that today, and you got a 40-year-old quarterback. So I think that does come into play with Sean. He's worried about winning now. You know, and as he gets up in age, the one thing I find with him is, and he's always sort of said, yeah, I don't know if I'll be a lifer in this business. I think he's more worried about winning now than ever before. And I think that's just getting older as a coach.
Mike, real quick, appreciate your time, brother. I want you to go ahead and let the folks know there's still time to get your draft report. Can you tell the listeners where they need to go and how they can make that happen?
Yeah, they can go on to SaintsReport.com and order it from there. Also, MikeDetillier.com, but both sites, SaintsReport.com, MikeDetillier.com, and we'll get it out to first class, and they'll get it in a day or so.
Mike, appreciate you taking some time out for us, as always, brother. Enjoy the draft. I know this is a great time of year for you, and enjoy your Easter weekend.
Thanks so much, guys. Y'all take care. Happy Easter to everyone.
That's a draft guru legend right there, Mike Detillier, Louisiana's own, breaking down next week's NFL draft for us right here on RP3 and Company. When we come back, it'll be time for a very quick, speedy version of RPOs with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game.
There's no time for the intro today, Raymond. We're going to dive right in.
Blue Poncho! Blue Poncho!
Right. We're going to jump right in to it. I've got one simple question for you on this week's edition of RPOs with RP3, and it does indeed involve the Easter weekend that is upon us.
I'm ready, sir.
Dying eggs, fighting eggs, hiding eggs, and hunting eggs. A lot of egg traditions come around this weekend, Raymond, so I need to know from you, RPO, on fighting eggs or pocking eggs being the best egg tradition during Easter.
I pass on that. Now, we do it in our household.
I understand.
We do it in our household.
What's better than fighting eggs, though?
You get to dye the eggs with a kid, man.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, now they'll get to the point where the kid won't want to do it, and then it'll probably become pocking eggs.
Right.
But right now, it's seeing her face dyeing the eggs. Ooh, Daddy, let's make it this color. And then she takes it out before it's done, and she wants to put it in the other color, and it turns out like brown. And I'm like, no, that's not how that works.
Right, and you get the little wax crayon that never works quite right.
It never works. Your design never comes out right. That's what's in the most enjoyable portion of Easter for me in the Parts household. When we come back here, Tyler Nunez from Tiger Rag going to make some time for us on Good Friday right here on 103.7 The Game. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has proclaimed the month of April as Safe Digging Month in Louisiana as part of a nationwide safety awareness campaign to draw attention to the importance of safe digging. In Louisiana, there are thousands of miles of utility lines and gas pipelines buried just beneath the surface. So if you or a contractor that you have hired is digging a hole to put in a new fence, a pool, or even a garden, you run the risk of hitting an underground line even by digging only a few inches. That's why it's so important for everyone to dial 811 and call Louisiana One Call 2 days before they dig. You just tell the operator your address and someone will come out and mark the location of buried lines so you and your contractor can avoid them. It's simple, it's free, and it's the law. All diggers and demolishers are required to notify Louisiana One Call before they begin work. The law applies to individuals as well as contractors, municipalities, and others. Failure to call can subject the digger to fines and liability for damages to buried infrastructure. Call 811 and know what's below before you dig. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I am your host, Raymond Parsa III, right here on 103.7 The Game. I'm broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. It's time now for us to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on our fourth and final guest of this Good Friday edition of the show. He covers the LSU football and basketball teams for Tiger Rag. It's the one and only Tyler Nunes. Tyler, how are you this morning, brother?
Man, I got the Finn Balor music this morning. I'm doing well now.
There it is. There it is. That's our gift to you for this Easter weekend, my friend. So I guess we have nothing to talk about concerning LSU, right, Tyler? Nothing happened this week?
No, it was a very slow, quiet weekend.
Slow.
Nothing happened whatsoever.
All right, brother. Let's start. You and I had talked about this off air about a few weeks or so ago, where we talked about, you know, there had been this talk about people being unhappy with Joe Oliva. And now it finally came to a head. They had the board meeting, and then, boom, Wednesday, it's announced that he was, quote-unquote, stepping down from his role. Were you surprised at all by the news and when it occurred?
I don't know if surprise is the right word. It's a complicated issue, with, as your intro says, a lot of ins, outs, and what have yous, but I don't think that this Will Wade situation is really what led to this. I think this was coming for a long time. I think the Will Wade situation acted as a catalyst. I thought that there might be a chance that he would stay on board, especially after they got Will Wade back. But apparently it was the final straw. There's been tension seemingly between Oliva and F. King Alexander as far back as going to when during the Les Miles debacle. So, I can't say surprise is the right word. I don't know if I expected it to happen this week, but I guess when it happened, it seems like they had everything lined up, considering they got a new AD later that day before the body was even cold.
Do you believe, Tyler, that the new AD was already in place before they made that move, and was the new AD already in place when they reinstated Will Wade?
Yeah, those deals aren't made in the span of a couple hours. There had clearly been conversations between LSU's athletics department and the LSU Board of Supervisors and Scott Woodward over at Texas A&M. Obviously, they have plenty of ends that he used to work for LSU. He's a Baton Rouge guy. So it's not like this came out of nowhere. I think that there's definitely conversations that were had beforehand, and I think that this was a done deal probably before Will Wade was even back. This was a done deal before that meeting.
We're talking to Tyler Nunes of Tiger Rag. Tyler, Joe Oliva's tenure in LSU is going to be remembered for what?
Man, that's a tough one. Probably just scandal is not the right word, but just kind of frustrating situation after frustrating situation, I think. I think that for me, I think the new facilities that he's put out on campus is really impressive. I mean, LSU has had – everyone's calling LSU an everything school right now, and I know that everyone likes to kind of poo-poo what Joe Oliva's done for that, but he's played a major role in getting LSU to where it's at athletically. But I think the fact that you have the Les Miles situation where he had Jimbo Fisher lined up and ended up keeping him under the direction of F. King Alexander, and then having to fire him midseason and getting Coach O. You've got the Will Wade situation. You've got the Florida debacle, which everyone loved at the time, but then LSU lost to Florida at home, and then all of a sudden it was a bad decision. I think it's just one of those things where he got a lot of bad luck, and then he was a scapegoat for a lot of bad things that happened. And I think that that's how he's going to be remembered. He's going to be remembered as the guy that kind of took the heat for a lot of bad situations and never really got credit for the good ones.
Should LSU be surprised, though, looking back, Tyler? And I know hindsight is what it is, but he was at the forefront of the Duke lacrosse scandal, which he mishandled. And there was reports even back then that Duke was leaning towards firing him, and yet LSU welcomed him with open arms.
No one's leaving the Duke athletic director job to come to LSU's athletic director job. Let's be completely honest with ourselves here. That's not a step up in both in paycheck and donors and everything. Like this is a much more difficult job to have. So I think that was definitely the case. You can compare it to when Trent Johnson left LSU to go to TCU. Obviously, he didn't want to, but that's the way things were trending, and that's how I ended up at LSU. And he did mishandle that. And again, I think it wasn't completely his fault. I think what Joe Oliva served as was kind of he did what he was told. He was he listened very well. He was also a great financial guy. But as far as like big controversial situations go, he listened to the university president. And that's how he handled a lot of these situations. And he took most of the heat for most of it. And I think by the end of it, he was getting kind of fed up with it. And I think that's kind of what led to the tension between him and Alexander and what ultimately led to him stepping down. I do think, although I sound sympathetic to Oliva right now, I do think the fact that they were able to go out and get Scott Woodward makes this a win for LSU. I think that this is a positive direction for the university to go in. He only had a year and a half left on his contract. I'm pretty sure that's what the new job title was for. And I think that this is overall a positive direction for LSU to be taken.
Let's talk a little bit about that, the new guy in charge. You know, this is a man who was able to get Chris Peterson away from Boise State to come to Washington. And then he arrives in College Station, and he lands Jimbo Fisher when Joe Oliva couldn't. And then he turns around, and he's just got done hiring Buzz William, one of the most respected coaches in the game and one of the biggest names out there for a coach, and he's also not afraid to fire guys. He fired Kevin Sumlin at Texas A&M. He also fired Billy Kennedy. So what are your impressions of Woodward's track record? Because it seems to be he has a really good resume, Tyler.
He's probably the biggest up-and-coming athletics director in the country right now, just based on everything you just said. He has a phenomenal resume. He's still got a lot of years left in positions like that if he wants them. He's got a great reputation for going out and getting coaches and then cutting coaches loose whenever they're not performing. He's the real deal. He also facilitated a lot of financial and great new facilities over at Texas A&M, so LSU won't be lacking there. I think that he's done a really good job everywhere he's been. And the fact that he's a Baton Rouge guy, the fact that he went to Catholic high school, I think that it's about as good for LSU as possible. It's about as good a match made in heaven as possible. So we'll see, obviously, that sometimes dream hires turn into nightmares in the span of a few years. So, it's nothing set in stone, but LSU really did hit a home run here, seemingly.
Talking to Tyler Nunes at Tiger Ag. Tyler, you know, he's going to come in. There's no, you know, everyone's kind of set. Well, as set as it can be. Will Wade has now been reinstated. Ed O got, you know, he has his contract. He's good to go. Paul Maneri's not going anywhere. So, really, he's also walking into a situation that really he's not going to have to worry about making a hire, at least on the surface, not for a while, correct? Maybe women's basketball in a year if things don't turn around there. Say that again?
I think that it's probably an ideal situation for Woodward coming in. You know, Joe Oliva came in and he had to hire a basketball coach. I think he interviewed seven guys in a day and a half and landed on Trent Johnson, which people give him a lot of trash for. But if you're brand new to a program and you're trying to hire a basketball coach, one that a coach you've never really had to hire before, and then you only have a couple days to do it, that's a tough situation. Scott Woodward's not going to have anything like that. All the coaches seem to be in good standing right now. We still have to wait and see how this federal basketball trial plays out. We're still not sure if Will Wade's going to have to testify. So, and that starts on Monday. But overall, it looks like Scott Woodward's going to be able to ease himself in, get comfortable with the program before he's going to have to make any program-changing decisions. And I think that's ideal.
Tyler, let's talk, though. This is just adds another layer, this hire, to this blossoming rivalry between Texas A&M and LSU that you and I have talked about.
Love it.
Right? And this is just another layer of everything from defensive coordinator leaving a couple years ago with Chavis, and then there's a lawsuit involved, and then Jimbo doesn't go to LSU. He instead goes to A&M, and then they have the record-setting game last year, which ended up being a loss for LSU, controversial fashion. Then there was the brawl afterwards with Jimbo's nephew. This is got so much juice to it, and now they poach their AD. This is great for LSU, right, to have a real rivalry now with someone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people were hesitant to accept Texas A&M as, you know, kind of a rivalry figure. Everyone kind of complained when they replaced Arkansas with that in the last game of the season. But, man, like, the LSU for my entire life has never really had a rivalry. You've had the Arkansas with the ugly boot trophy. You've had there were a few years where Alabama was a decent rivalry, but this is like an actual rivalry with actual bad blood between the athletics departments, and this is something that LSU has not had, I guess, Tulane back in the day. I wasn't alive, so I don't really understand the vitriol that was there, if there was any, but I knew there was a towel. But there may not be a trophy for this.
It's a rag. It's a rag, Tyler.
Rag. You know.
Oh, I love that. I love that. But you're right. You're right. Continue. Sorry. I had that. You
no,
gave us
yeah, my point is, it's been a really long time, you know, since LSU's had a rivalry. And this is a rivalry that transcends just football. This is a rivalry that goes all the way up to the athletic department. These athletics departments have, they're poaching coaches from each other. LSU just poached their athletics director. This is just something that you can't. This is bad blood on a level that you can't get just from stuff happening on a football field or a basketball court or a baseball field. This is bad blood that goes all the way up and down to the institution. So I think that this is going to be a lot of fun to watch, see how all of this plays out. I'm curious to see who Texas A&M gets as their next athletics director. But it's going to be...
Please make it Joe Oliva. Please make it Joe Oliva.
Rivalry is the best part of college. And LSU has a bona fide rival now.
I'm so hoping they hire Joe Oliva.
Oh, God.
Okay, Tyler, let's wrap it up with this. Draft is next week. Devin White looks to be a locked-in guy in the top five, no later than the top 10. Greedy Williams, though, has been coming up and down the draft boards, and a lot of that is smoke and mirrors, right? A lot of that is BS being thrown out there by agents. They're trying to pump up their other guys and talking to people. Do you believe, though, Greedy's going to be a first-round pick, or do you think he falls to the second?
He's so hard to read because he hasn't had any meetings with any teams, as far as I'm aware, which isn't bad. It's just kind of unprecedented.
The only other guy was Tyler Eifert. That I remember. Tyler Eifert didn't take any meetings either, right? And that's the last guy I remember that was still drafted fairly high.
Yeah, it's not bad. Like I said, it's not a bad thing. You can get drafted highly without. It's just not normal, right? It's just weird, and it gives you a hard time of seeing like who wants to, you know, take a chance on him. And then he didn't do a lot of the combine either. So I don't know. It's really hard to read exactly where he's going to go because, like you said, we're just kind of basing this off of like what agents are saying it's not like these guys that are going to be in the war room are, you know, divulging their secrets. And if they are, they're not honest. So we're just going to see with Greedy. He's going up to Nashville. I think that's a good sign. He has a really good chance of getting drafted in the first round. If not, he's a lock as a second round pick. He's just too talented to let go too far. But it's an interesting situation. I don't really know how to read the Greedy Williams situation.
Tyler, appreciate you making time for us as always, brother. And I hope you and yours have a happy Easter this weekend. Be safe out there, and we'll talk to you next week, my friend.
Most definitely. Have a good one, Ray.
That might have been the highlight of the show, today's show, Cody.
Which part?
The rivalry part.
Right? Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I want you to know, we opened him up with the WWE theme, Finn Balor. It's also, Finn Balor theme is folded into the intro of Tiger Rag, which is how I knew he would enjoy that.
Nice.
But... he also, at the end there, talking about Texas A&M, he threw out the term bad blood, what, a half dozen times or so throughout that little conversation. Bad blood, also, at one point in time, a WWE pay-per-view.
Oh, nice.
So,
nice.
I think he was doing that on purpose, nice. And he popped me a little bit in my chair here. So, well done, Mr. Nunez.
When we come back, we'll put a bow on this edition of RP3 and Company and the week right here on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to this Good Friday edition of RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game. Broadcasting live, as always, from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. Terrific conversation today with our guests. I want to thank them all real quick. Kyle Cormier, longtime head baseball coach, nearly 20 years at the helm of the Brobridge baseball program. They are currently the number one ranked team in all of Class 4A, and they will begin the postseason next week. Appreciate him coming on, making some time for us. Also, our boy Barry Hurstis, he is amped up for the draft. My man is ready for the draft to begin right now from the Saints News Network and Big Easy Magazine. Also, a big thanks to the draft guru himself, the one and only Mike Dettillier, coming on, sharing his knowledge with us about what he thinks some LSU guys are going to do, some Saint, and what the Saints are going to do. And also, thanks for Tyler Nunes for bringing the knowledge, or lack of, about the Tulane LSU rivalry, which was hilarious.
That was really funny. That was pretty funny.
He had no idea.
He said, I know there was a towel. It's not. It was a rag. And it burned up in a fire, right?
Well, I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. I'm pretty sure it burned in a fire. It was being held at...
No, it still exists, doesn't it?
I think they made a new one, but I think the original Tiger rag was burned in a fire. And you want to know why I know that, or why I think I know that? From the NCAA football game, like 2000, whatever it was.
That. You have to play for it.
You can play for it. And then when you play a rivalry game, it gives you like the little spiel about the rivalry before the game,
during the loading screen.
And I believe that was where the thing was about the original Tiger rag burning in a fire. I'm gonna look that up real quick.
I'm glad you brought up the NCAA football game, because, by the way, they need to bring that back. But you know what I used to do back in the day when I'd play that? I'd take over Tulane,
mm-hmm.
and then after like 5 years of like, you know, franchise mode or legend mode or whatever they were calling it back in the day, you know what
right.
I did?
What?
I would make Tulane so good that they would knock Kentucky out of the SEC or Vanderbilt and add me back to the SEC.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, I get a Heisman Trophy winner at Tulane. Like, that's not going to happen. Come on now. But I still had fun with it.
I mean, yeah, there was one of my, I used to put, I think I've told you this before, that I, yeah, there was a, it was believed that the flag was destroyed in a 1982 fire at Tulane's University Center. In 2001, the flag was reconstructed. So there you go.
And yet, but they don't play anymore.
No.
So it's not like, you know, it's just like, oh, okay, great. That's tremendous.
Yep. But we're done here. I've got a fish fry.
What are you doing? What are you doing this weekend for the Easter weekend, Cody?
Fish fry tonight at my brother's in Zachary.
Nice.
Going to the wife's family's somewhere. They got a camp somewhere on some bayou. I don't remember the name of it, but we're going to do that on Saturday.
On some bayou.
Yeah.
On some bayou.
And then Easter Sunday, a little crawfish bowl at the grandparents.
Nice. We're probably going to go to Good Friday service tonight at our church. May go over catch UL softball.
There you go.
Raging Cajuns. My daughter loves watching them play. And then we're going to just relax, man. We're going to have a little Easter egg hunt on Sunday, and we'll have the Parch Easter Games, 4th edition, by the way.
Look out.
My wife gets very competitive.
I need you to bring home that sack race trophy, brother.
Oh, nice. Y'all have a great weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday. Happy Easter.